I'm going to read to you from Romans 9, starting at verse 19. So I'm going to read Romans 9, 19 through to verse 29. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who can resist his will? But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is moulded say to its moulder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honourable use and another for dishonourable use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he has prepared beforehand for glory? Even us, whom he's called, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles, as indeed he says in Hosea, those who were not my people, I will call my people, and her who was not loved, I will call beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God. And Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. For the Lord will carry out his sentence upon the earth fully and without delay. And as Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts had not left us offspring, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. Just as we start, and this does tie in with what we're talking about loosely, is another book recommendation is Plugged In by Daniel Strange. So highly recommend it. It's I haven't read it all yet, but it's a very readable, easy book, and very useful. So it ties a lot of what we've thought about in midweeks together. And it's about how to understand and enjoy our culture and not to hide from it, not to rail against it and not to assimilate it, but also how to speak into it as well. And he uses an illustration, which is why I mentioned this, because this ties in with this morning and this evening. And he uses an illustration about a visiting professor, and the lecturer who was chairing the meeting. His lecturer was there, and every student who asked a question, the visiting professor changed the question, dramatically changed the question. Eventually, the lecturer who was chairing it pointed out, you haven't answered anybody's questions yet. And the visiting professor said, that's because they asked all the wrong questions. And of course, the students disengaged from his lecture. Now, the point that Daniel makes in this is that, as Christians, we sometimes feel like that. We feel frustrated. We're like the lecturer, the professor. We feel frustrated because the world is asking us the wrong questions. We have the answers, the most important thing they need to know. But that's not what they're asking about. But actually, the point he makes is that the questions they ask do lead us there. And so, worth a read. But there are times, that professor has a point, that there are times we can't go straight to the question. We need to qualify it or flesh that out. Perhaps you've had an experience like that. If you've ever tried to ask Fran a question of science, about science, he tells you that your question just has so many more levels to it than you realise. We saw this morning in John chapter 3 when Nicodemus goes to Jesus. The gist of it is that his questions are fair enough. He's a genuine seeker, but they're far bigger than what he thought. And in chapter 9, like much of Romans, Paul answers legitimate questions, but often they are far bigger than the issue people come with. And he does that here. In fact, what he does at first looks quite dismissive. Now, a reminder about chapter 9. The issue in this chapter is God fair and trustworthy? Given the grand claims of chapter 8, that there's no condemnation, that there's no separation, can we trust God for it? And what raised that issue is the issue of the Jews. Why are there so few Jews in the church, relatively? Given the Old Testament history and the story and the promises of God to them, well, it sounds like a bit of niche theology at first, but It's like any friendship or a business relationship. Is this party, if this party has treated someone unreliable, how long will it be before they treat me in the same way? And so we all want to know, if I put my trust in Jesus, is he good for it? And the gist of Paul's answer here is, not what you'd expect, is, who do you think you are? So the question is, from what we've looked at already, if his will is irresistible, then how can he blame us? And Paul's answer is, who do you think you are? So far, Paul's answered these questions with a pretty straight bat, and he's sympathetic to inquiry. But some questions are different. Some questions are genuine, even if they're inadequate. They're genuine, there's something to work with. But some questions are used to dismiss a piece of biblical teaching. So some people in the church would go, ah, but what about this Bible verse here? Then this. And so that means we can get rid of Romans 9, for example. And some use questions to dismiss God entirely. And so Paul here uses an illustration, as he often does. But it's important to say something about this illustration. Illustrations illustrate. They make a point. But they don't teach everything that's to be said about everything. They don't teach everything that's to be said about the subject. So you can't draw more from it than the point Paul is making. And so the question is, verse 19, you will say to me then, why does he still find fault? Who can resist his will? How can God find fault with us if his will is irresistible? And there's three parts to Paul's answer. Firstly is, well, who are you? The second is, well, what if? What if God has purposes for different responses? And also he takes us back then to the Old Testament to see the grand plan. So firstly, who are you? Verses 19 to 21. And the point Paul is making here is there's a gap between us and God. How we are not like God. That is not everything to be said. So there's always ways in which we are. There is a way in which we are like God. And there's important ways we're not. So we are created in his image. There's a way we are like him. So we are accountable and we have dignity and more creativity and so on. But there's other ways we are not like him. We are created by him. So what we have is derived from him. And we must maintain that distinction. So the dignity we have is a dignity that has been imprinted on us by God. And so we must understand that difference. And what kind of difference that is. And so Paul says, well, who do you think you are, given that difference? Now, there's a similar answer we get in the book of Job. The book of Job addresses the issue of suffering. And after the initial bit of a sort of conversation in heaven and the things that happen to Job, the bulk of the book is his friends come to Job and they're absolutely no help at all. And that's the bulk of the book, is a bunch of useless friends giving their opinions. And the issues in Job are this. The friends say Job is suffering. We can see that. So therefore, Job must have sinned. Then Job says, well, I know I didn't sin, but I'm suffering, so God can't be fair. And then the book ends with God speaking. And basically, they're all wrong. The friends and Job are wrong. And the conclusion is, God doesn't quite go where you expect him to go. He says, did you make the big sea creatures? Did you create the weather? Do you understand the weather and where it comes from? No. Well, then you better pipe down then. You're out of your league in dealing with this question. When he sees God's power and wisdom, Job is humbled and realizes he's been asking the wrong questions and the wrong way. God is above his ways. And that might not be the answer we were looking for, but it is the one that you need. And so we need to understand the gap. And that's what Paul is speaking about here. We need to understand the gap. Who are you to talk back if it's not a genuine inquiry? I've used some of my own catchphrases, but my predecessor used a good one. God is God and you are not. And that's what Paul is getting at here. That God is God and you are not. Now, something we know in our culture is that our culture has become anti-expert. And there's some good reasons for that and some bad reasons for that. But it's how it is. Experts know more than you about their field. Teachers know more than their class. That's why there's a class there. That's why there's a teacher there. Doctors advise you based on their knowledge and experience. In fact, they're not allowed to do it to themselves. Doctors have to go to the doctor. But now that's not the case. Now, doctors are often ignored. People know better than their teachers and their experts. We also do the same with God. But it is different when we come to God. You see, a teacher can be surpassed eventually. If you think about, state the obvious, the teacher once had a teacher and they go on and teach. And sometimes they teach at a higher level and so on. Experts have to have their ideas tested by peers. And there's always someone who has a counter idea to what the experts say. Also, expertise is relative. You say, I don't want a virologist fixing my plumbing any more than want the plumber developing a vaccine. We will have our areas of to do with our job that we know more than other people around us. But God is different. We tend to think God is like us, but bigger and better. That's not adequate. He is holy. He is other. He is beyond comparison. We thought about touching on that this morning. He's on a different plane. He's a different mode of being to us. He knows all that has been, all that is, all that will be, all that could have been if things had been different. And he knows those things to an eternal level in enormous detail, in complete detail. And he's wise, not just that he knows things. In fact, he is wise. That doesn't always go together, but it does with God. He's wise beyond anything we can get, to the point that his wisdom to us is so different that it looks crazy. It's not just that he is better, he is different. And the only way we know what God is like at all is by what he reveals to us. And that his character is not contradictory, even if we can't hold all the bits together in our mind. But where God has not filled in the gaps for us, we are ignorant. And we have to put our hands up and say, we are ignorant. And it's not, we're not to fill in those gaps ourselves, because our logic and our reasoning, frankly, are not up to it. So God is gracious to us. He's so gracious. He's gracious in how he's revealed himself to us and how he's included us in his plans and uses us. But sometimes we get carried away with this grace and we think that somehow when what God does or acts is different to how we would have done it, then somehow he's subject to us. And so we start to think, hang on, that's not fair. That's not right. You can't act like that. And we forget who God is. He does not make mistakes. He does not overlook things. He's never forced into a corner. And so that's what this illustration about the pottery is about. That was a long way into saying something very simple. The image that Paul gives here is a potter being questioned. Not questioned by a consumer or a client who's on his level, perhaps not his expertise in pottery, but another person. But the clay itself. Could you imagine the clay going, well, no, I don't think I should be made into this because of what you've done with those bits of clay over there. Clay doesn't negotiate. It is there to be shaped into whatever the potter has a purpose for. It could be to be used as a bedpan or high-end diningware. It could be thrown out. It's up to him entirely for the purposes he had for the clay. Now Paul here is drawing on an Old Testament illustration from Jeremiah and from Isaiah. In Jeremiah, the point is that God is the potter who reshapes the clay into something else. In Isaiah, Israel reverses the clay potter role and put themselves in God's place. And through Isaiah, they're told, woe to him who quarrels with his maker. So the point here is not that this is everything to be said about God and people or asking questions, but to understand that God is on a higher plane than us. So with the other things, Paul has answered the questions fairly directly. Maybe you need to flesh out a bit more. But here he's saying we can only know what we are told, and we can't understand fully his purposes, other than he has purposes. Any more than that is clay answering back. And so we have to be humbled before our God. We need to know who we are and who he is before we start talking about fairness. And if God's got irresistible will, how's that fair? And so on. And we come before him humbled. So that's sort of like a big point about thinking about God. But the next thing he talks about is what if in verses 22 to 25. What if God has these particular purposes? His purposes are beyond us in many ways. There's a mystery. Now, mystery can't be used by some as an excuse to say we don't know anything. Oh, God's so far above us, we can't know anything. And therefore, let's not try. Or let's just make it up. But that's not right in a number of ways. But there is a mystery in that the mystery is revealed to us, but there are things that are mysterious about them. We are told things, we're told lots of things about God, and those things we can know truly, but often we're told that they are, not how they are. We're told what the mystery is, we're not told about all the loose ends. And so here Paul expands on verse 18 that we looked at last week. So last week we heard, so he has mercy on whomever he wills, and he hardens whomever he wills. And so the question is, well, if that's the case, then why are we accountable? Well, we know from the rest of the Bible, especially from Paul's writings, who's the most explicit on this, including in the book of Romans itself, that God loves to show mercy. And mercy is mercy. It means it's not deserved. We know from elsewhere, he doesn't desire the death of a sinner. We know he stands with his arms wide open to hold out the offer of salvation in his son Jesus Christ. And he longs for that salvation to be received. We also know that many will reject that offer and that they are accountable for that rejection. And that rejection grieves God. For example, Jesus wept over Jerusalem. But we also know that we only receive that offer if the Holy Spirit opens people's hearts first, and that those are those who God foreknew and predestined in eternity. And Paul says here, some he knew were made to demonstrate his mercy, and some were made to demonstrate his justice. But those who rejected, notice here, God has been patient and merciful with. He's been patient and merciful with everybody. God was patient and merciful to Pharaoh, who we thought about last week. Pharaoh rejected God, and God uses Pharaoh to demonstrate his justice. But he'd been so patient with him and merciful to him. And he uses Pharaoh's rejection to save his people. Now, people don't like this. And they say, well, that's not fair. And the answer Paul gives back is, sorry, what was that piece of clay? It doesn't make sense to bring such an objection. It's not our place. It's not within our understanding. But what we know is that God is just, he's merciful and fair and patient, and Pharaoh rejected him. And so we know that to approach God and his word, to be humble, that it is above us. He is above us, whilst not being ignorant of those things that have been revealed to us. And the point here in chapter 9 is that chapter 8 is still true. There is no condemnation. There's no separation for those who love Christ. So we need to fit this into the big plan. And the big plan we find in the Old Testament is that God is consistent in verses 24 to 29. So these questions have arisen because of an issue in the Old Testament. The Old Testament makes these promises to Israel. How do we square that with the New Testament? How about we see today? And if you can't, can we take anything God says seriously? Is there a plan, or is he making it up as he goes along? In fact, this is all in the Old Testament, and there's two places Paul goes to there to show us that. He goes to Hosea and Isaiah. So in Hosea, in verses 24 to 26 here, he goes to Hosea 2:23 and 1:10. Hosea is a prophet going to Israel in the north. His life is like, his marriage is like a parallel of the message he brings. He married someone called Gomer, and their relationship is a parallel between Israel and God. Gomer turned out to be very adulterous and left him in the end. But Hosea remained faithful to her and brought her back. But part of the prophecy is he's saying that those who are not God's people will become God's people. And Hosea prophesies that the Gentiles will come in with an equal share to the people of God. God will save Gentiles, people like us, or most of us. That much is clear in the Old Testament. We see from time to time. But as the prophets look forward, in time, it will be large numbers of Gentiles. And of course, Gentiles outnumber Jews massively. That will far outnumber Israelites in the people of God. Not that they replace Israel as much, but they'll be added to them as God's people and will be added on an equal footing. There's no hierarchy in that respect in the people of God. And then in Isaiah, he quotes in verses 27 to 29, and he's quoting there from Isaiah 10, 22 to 23, and chapter 1, verse 9. Just a reminder, we looked at Isaiah a little while ago. Isaiah is speaking to Judah in the south, warning them what happened to Israel in the north when they were dispersed. He's saying, the south, you're going to ignore what happened, and you're going to be exiled, but also you're going to return. He also thinks about the Gentiles included as well. And notice what he says here. Israel will have many sons, but only a remnant will be saved. So there's a theme in the Old Testament of a faithful remnant. Often there's a large group who presume on God, but they don't have faith. Sometimes they rebel against him entirely. And yet always, no matter what's happening in the big picture, always God preserves a faithful remnant. And so in the exile, a faithful remnant will preserve. And that actually narrows down until we get to one man, Jesus. And most Jews don't receive the promise. They don't take their promises they've been given and add faith to it. Even so, it's not the case that there are no Christian Jews. There are Jews in the church, and there always have been. And there always will be a faithful remnant. And so, when we take Hosea and Isaiah together, what we'd expect from the prophets is just what we see in Paul's day and our own. Large numbers of Gentiles coming to Christ and so become the people of God, and many Jews not adding faith to the promises they received. But still, a faithful group do. It's always a faithful group that does. Now that raises yet more questions for another week. So why only a remnant? Why not the majority of them? Will this always be so? Well, keep coming back. We'll hear some answers to those. And those will bring to us, Gentiles in the 21st century, a number of warnings and encouragements for us personally. But the big point here is, yes, God is faithful and merciful. That's what we keep hearing in chapter 9. He brings judgment to those who do not turn to him. And there is no contradiction between that and his predestined, distinguishing love, and that he desires not to see people lost. I can't square those, but they're just revealed to us. He has a purpose for all, even those who end up as objects of wrath because of their stubbornness. But he is patient and has been patient and merciful to all. To all. He does not save all, but that's what makes their rejection of God's offer even more inexcusable, that he has been merciful and patient to all. We don't need to defend God about his judgment, that he chooses who he will, or anything else the Bible says, actually. There's some bits of the Bible I wouldn't lead on for a guest event. I wouldn't go straight to a controversial bit that's odds with our culture. We need to look at it as Christians, but I wouldn't go to that for a guest service of some kind. But actually what I found with non-Christians, when they bring it up, it is worth discussing, because their objection is, God disagrees with me. Well, does that disqualify him as God? Would you expect, if there is such a thing as a God, that he would agree with you all of the time and that you're always right? They concede pretty quickly that would be unlikely. And then we have a fruitful discussion. God is God, and you are not. And you need to come to him and his word in humility, because you need him to reveal himself to you. Some things we're told, but we struggle to fully reconcile them. But what we need to know, we know. He is good, he is merciful, and he is for us. And so even now, do not harden your hearts to him, but receive the offer, and keep receiving the offer he holds out to you.